I will resist all temptations of love, I will not vacillate, I beg of you, give me initiation. Tahotep smiles again and strokes my hair. I feel tremendous power flowing through his hand and into my head like a strong current. Truly, he says, I am not accustomed to this type of behavior. Do you think, my child, that when I tell you I won't initiate you and you throw yourself on your knees before me, this will make me change my mind? One of the requirements of initiation is absolute self-control. Child, child, you still have a long way to go on the path of self-control. And your self-assurance is not in equilibrium with your experiences. First gain the necessary experience, then you can come back. I see that he has nothing more to say. I stand up and take leave of him. Father of my soul, I'll go now, but you're not going to abandon me, are you? May I come back to you again some other time? Tahotep answers with ineffable love. I know that you have been alone very much ever since your early childhood and you still are. It just had to be that way so you could develop your self-reliance. But you are never alone and you must feel that, really. You are united with us by the eternal band of the highest laws of affinity and association. I am always with you even when you do not know it. I knew before you did that you were coming to me today with this request, and I also know what will follow. But there are laws, which even we must obey. You belong to us. I bow low before him to receive his benediction. Then I go. Waiting for me in the antechamber, Menu asks, how was it? What did the Son of God tell you? Please tell me everything. Right away. I just couldn't understand what was keeping you so long. Please, please, tell me. Are you going to be initiated? The Son of God will not give it to me. He says I haven't had any experience in earthly life. Thank God, says Menu, beaming with joy, didn't I tell you it wouldn't be good for you to be initiated? I knew it. Yes, yes, Menu, you know everything better, but just leave me in peace now. I want to put some order in my thinking. And we walk on silently back to the palace. All night long and all the next day I can think only of Tahotep, the representative of God. I have known that on the basis of my ancestry I belong to the sons of God, but it was a great experience to hear from him that he is the guardian of my soul. He is the visible representative of God here on earth, and I know I could speak as openly to him about my most secret thoughts as in my own innermost prayers to God. His eyes saw right through me. His glance illumined the hiddenmost corners of my soul, and that made me happy. It is so wonderful to know that I belong to a living being who understands me without words and who can never be angry with me because he sees everything from above, just as God himself does. I don't need to explain to him what I mean, or why I want to do something or achieve something, as I am accustomed to have to do with my tutors. Tahotep sees the most secret motives behind my thoughts and my deeds, even those I am not conscious of myself. I don't even need to say a word to him, it is enough when I merely stand before him. He sees me. His spirit is open for me, and I feel I am in constant contact with him. I even felt it before I met him. I felt a force as strong as steel was guiding me, and now I know this force was, and is, his radiation. I know that he even sees me when I am not with him. Even now I feel his eyes upon me, whatever I do or think is not hidden before him. And in this case he can also see that I cannot take no for an answer on the question of my being initiated. No. I can't see why I should first have to have experiences in love behind me. I'll never fall in love. Men only interest me to the extent that I expect them to notice and admire my beauty. Since they all do that, it's quite enough for me, for vanity is only at work in me when I am in the company of others. When I am alone, there is only one wish that fills my whole soul, initiation. I cannot and will not wait until I have had the experience of falling in love, because I never will. And so that evening, accompanied by a very worried Menu, I go again to Tahotep to ask him once more for my initiation. Once again Menu waits in the antechamber, while the neophyte takes me to the garden where Tahotep is sitting under the palm trees. I bow before him. He returns my greeting, looks at me with his shining eyes, I feel he's looking into me, and weeps. I stand and say nothing. Why should I speak when he knows anyway what I want? He reads my thoughts. He lets me stand. Finally he gets up, lays his hands on my shoulders and asks, why have you come? Father of my soul, I reply, why do you ask when you already know anyway? I am unhappy because you refuse to initiate me. I have no other wishes, no other thoughts, only initiation. Please give me initiation. Tahotep strokes my hair lovingly and says quite earnestly, almost sadly, I gave you your answer yesterday, just be calm and have patience. Remember what I told you yesterday about creative power, and live your life as other young people do. Occupy yourself with your flowers and with your animals, go and play with other young people, enjoy yourself and for the time being don't think about initiation. Father, I reply in agitation, I can think only about initiation. Whatever I do guides my thoughts directly back to initiation. When I look at my flowers, or when I watch my turtles crawling back and forth and living their life as wisely as if they had an intellect, I run into secrets and mysteries to which I would like to know the answers. I would like to know everything, understand everything, I'd like to be initiated. If the turtles had an intellect, says Tahotep smiling, they wouldn't lead such a wise life. And now you don't want to be wise because you have an intellect, but because you have too much intellect. But now just try with your excellent intellect to understand that you're still too young to be initiated. Come back again when you have your earthly experiences behind you. Then I will give you your initiation. Oh my! It's not so easy to deal with Tahotep as with my dear old Menu. Tahotep is hard, and all my strength bounces off him like arrows off a stone wall. Again I bow low before him and go. But outside I answer Menu's questions in a spirit of rage and desperation, rage because Tahotep thinks I am too young, and desperation because I stand powerless in the face of time rising up before me like an impenetrable wall, as invincible as Tahotep himself. All that night I can't sleep again, and all the next day I pace back and forth in my room, as restless and unhappy as the trained lions in the lion's court. Through being born into my body, my consciousness has been dulled and deadened, I feel as if I were in perpetual darkness. I want to see clearly even though I am imprisoned in the body. I want to know. I want to be initiated. Why should I wait? If love is a matter of indifference to me now, it will still be when I am initiated and omniscient. I already know that physical love is only a necessity of nature to carry on the race. Why should it be dangerous for me not to know this from experience? I have my intellect and my consciousness and they will protect me from this danger. I won't fall into nature's trap, the trap of love. I'll be able to resist this temptation all right. In this manner I brood all day long. By the time evening comes again, I just can't stand it any longer. I take my veil and go again with Menu through the long colonnade to the temple, to Tahotep. I want to tell him that I'm not afraid of this temptation, that I'll be strong enough, that he can initiate me. Oh how blind I was! How foolish! As if Tahotep had not seen the future clearly. As if he had not known how everything was going to turn out. But even he must obey the divine law and watch patiently, as I run headlong into my undoing. Watch patiently as I plunge head over heels into an abyss, only to have to climb out later by my own strength. He receives me again in his little reception room. I enter, bow, and tell him with all the determination I can muster, Father of my soul, I wanted to obey you, but I cannot. I long so much for knowledge that I've come back again. I cannot see why I should wait when I'm absolutely sure I have enough strength to withstand the temptations of physical love. I am strong enough. I have self-control. Please give me the initiation. At this Tahotep closes his shining eyes and remains motionless a long time. I wait with inward impatience, but outwardly without moving a muscle in order not to disturb him. Finally, Tahotep opens his eyes. He stands up, comes over to me, takes up my hands in his, and says, "Three times you have asked to be initiated. Three times, despite my refusal. It is a law that when a member of the tribe of the Sons of God asks three times to be initiated, we cannot refuse him any longer. It is a sign that initiation is necessary for him, regardless of the danger he may risk as a result of it. I will speak to your physical father. We will need to discuss how you can carry on your duties during the time of initiation. Other neophytes normally live in the temple during this time, but with you we will have to make an exception because you have to fulfill the duties of the wife of the Pharaoh. Now go in peace." I feel like throwing myself about his neck to thank him for giving me his permission to be initiated, but I prefer to show him I can control myself. I stand motionless, and my eyes express my joy. Tahotep smiles at me and says, "What you've done in thought, you've already done, don't ever forget it. Oh, Father, if you already regard me as having done it, then I will really." And with that I throw myself into his arms and kiss his noble face, right and left. "I thank you, I thank you. How wonderful. I'm going to be initiated." "Initiated? Yes, I can see you have tremendous self-control," says Tahotep. "Only now, Father," I answer with a joyous laugh, "only now. After all, you're not only the high priest, but my own blood uncle. So I can kiss you, can't I? But when I'm initiated, you will see how serious I am and how much self-control I have." "Yes, I know," says Tahotep, embracing me lovingly. Then he strokes my head again and leads me to the door. We take leave of each other. Dancing and skipping, practically walking on air, I go back to the palace with Menu. I am infinitely happy. But Menu, from the moment she hears that I am to be initiated in the temple, cries and wrings her hands continually as if I were dying. Her lamentations spoil the fun for me, and I feel as if surrounded by invisible shadows. Finally, at bedtime, when she starts again to talk about her gloomy forebodings, my patience is at an end. "Look, Menu," I tell her, "you know they wanted to take you away from me after my 16th birthday when I was presented to the country as the Pharaoh's wife. You know that according to the rules I should be surrounded by ladies of the court. It took me a hard fight to get the Pharaoh to agree to your staying on with me and to my being accompanied by ladies of the court only on high state occasions, the way things have been in the past. But if you act this way, I surely will have you sent away and take on the ladies of the court. To be sure, most of them are terribly boring, but at least they don't interfere in my private affairs." Menu, poor old fat Menu. She is so frightened at my words that she stops crying immediately, sits down on the floor beside my bed and looks at me silently but with so much love, so much care and solicitude that I can't help bursting out laughing. Throwing my arms about her, I tell her, "Just calm down, Menu, I'm not going to send you away. Never. I love you. You're the only person who really and truly loves me with all your heart. I'll always want you with me. Just calm your fears. The initiation will not harm me, only help me. Tahotep will take care of me. He will be with me always." Then in leaving, Menu says, "I hope the initiation really won't harm you, but I am always afraid when I see the big flashes of lightning and hear the thunder coming out of the pyramids. I hope you won't have anything to do with that." "No, no, Menu, now be a good girl and go to bed," I tell her, and Menu leaves. But for a little while I ponder over her parting remark. Lightning and thunder coming out of the pyramid? Yes, it's true. Ever since I was a little girl, I have known that lightning and thunder have struck out of the pyramid occasionally and after that it would rain. It was always as much a matter of course as life itself, and I never gave it a second thought. But now when I am initiated in the temple, I will probably learn the secret behind this phenomenon too. Then with a great and wonderful feeling of expectation, I fall asleep. Sons of God, the next day the Pharaoh summons me. I am to see him after his audience. At the appointed hour the controller of the royal household comes and escorts me to father. "Come, my child," says he, "I want to tell you what Dahotep and I have agreed upon about your initiation." "Did he come to see you?" "No," says father and looks at me quizzically. "Did you go to see him?" I ask again. "No again," he answers and smiles. "Father," I tell him, "for a long time I've wanted to ask you how you discuss things with Tahotep without going to see him or his coming to see you. I've often noticed that you've told me something about Tahotep as if the two of you had been together in a long consultation. And yet you had not left the palace and he had not come to see you. How was it possible, father?" Ever since my childhood father has been accustomed to my questions, and he now answers me as patiently as ever. "You have a mirror, and you have seen your head in this mirror, haven't you?" "Yes, father, I see my head every day when Menu does my hair." "And what have you noticed?" asks father. "That I have a much longer head than the sons of men in general. But you too, and Tahotep and most of the people in our race, the sons of God, as people call us, have the same longer head form. It's noticeable even in spite of the kerchief or headgear or ornaments the person might be wearing." "How is it, father? Why is the shape of our heads different from that of the heads of the sons of men?" "Look, my child, for you to understand many of the things here on earth, you must first know something about the earth's development. Just like all the celestial bodies in the universe and like all the forms of life on these celestial bodies, our earth is subject to the laws of constant change. The divinely creative forces radiate from the eternal infinite original source and in constantly expanding waves they penetrate the plane of matter. That is to say, matter is formed from these forces. This process reaches its highest point in ultramatter, then automatically reverses itself. The process of spiritualization begins again and the matter is transformed into force. But this process takes eons of time. The changes are going on regularly but so subtly and slowly that they cannot be noticed or observed in the course of a human life. On the other hand, some changes, which require thousands of years of slow and unnoticed preparation, occur suddenly and visibly when the proper time has come. Right now we are living in such a period of transition in which changes are noticeable. One of these phenomena is evident in the fact that various races of people with roundish skulls are led and governed by rulers who are spiritually greatly superior to them and who are even different from them physically. They have a more graceful figure and an elongated cranium. Once there lived on earth a race of people very different from the races living today. They manifested completely the law of spirit and not the law of matter like the races of people living today. These people were conscious on the divine plane and manifested God here on earth without any admixture of the self-seeking characteristics of the body. In their divine purity, these people deserved the name the sons of God. Their entire life was based on spirituality, love, and selflessness. And they had no physical appetites, urges and passions to cast shadows on the spirit. The members of this higher race possessed all the secrets of nature, and as they were perfectly acquainted with their own powers and kept these powers completely under the control of the spirit, they were also able to control and guide nature with all of its tremendous forces. Their knowledge was boundless. They did not need to earn their bread with physical toil, and instead of earning their livelihoods with the sweat of their brow, they put the forces of nature to work. They knew all the laws of nature, the mysteries of matter, the powers of the mind, and the secrets of their own being. They also knew the secret connected with the transformation of force into matter and of matter into force. They constructed devices and tools with which they could store up, set in motion, and utilize not only the forces of nature but also their own spiritual forces. They lived happily and peaceably as the dominant race in a great part of the earth. At the same time, however, other creatures similar to the sons of God were also living on earth, but with much more material bodies and on a much lower plane of development. Obtuse in spirit, their consciousness was completely identified with the body. They lived in primeval jungles, struggling with nature, each other, and animals. These creatures were the ancestors of present-day man. The race of the Sons of Men you see in our country represent a cross between these two races. As I said a moment ago, the law of constant motion and change is at work throughout the universe. The Earth is now going through a period in which the process of materialization is advancing. This means that the divinely creative power is moving farther and farther on into matter, and the power on Earth is gradually falling more and more into the hands of ever more material races of people who were once under the guidance of higher, more spiritual races. Little by little, the higher race is dying out. They are withdrawing from the plane of matter to the spiritual plane, and they will leave humanity alone for a period of time, as time is reckoned on Earth, many, many thousands of years, so that humanity may, without visible guidance, climb upward with its own power. And so it has come about that this animal-like material race of cavemen is experimenting in accordance with divine laws, growing mightier and more powerful until the time comes for it to begin ruling the Earth. Before leaving the Earth, however, the higher race had to implant its special powers in the lower race. Through the operation of the laws of heredity, this will enable the lower race, after a long, long process of development, to arise out of matter again. This is why many sons of the divine race made the great sacrifice of begetting children with the daughters of primitive man. Through this first crossing of the races, they have developed new individual types and, gradually, new races of people. The divine power of the sons of God and the mighty physical powers of the daughters of men have produced different types of descendants. On the one hand, physical, and on the other, spiritual giants. There have also been physical titans who, from their mother's ancestry, have inherited primitive, undeveloped brains. In these persons, the spiritual power of their fathers, working on the material plane, created tremendously strong bodies. With their gigantic physical strength, these individuals have overcome weaker persons and, because of the animal appetites of their nature, they have become tyrants greatly to be feared. But there have also been spiritual titans who have manifested their inherited creative power through the higher centers of the brain, rather than on the lower physical plane. These spiritual giants were assigned the task of leading and teaching for a time, the lower, animal-like, body-conscious race of humans, as well as the hybrid race which later arose through the interbreeding I have already mentioned. These spiritual giants have the task of teaching the people of these two races wisdom, sciences and arts as the basis of a higher civilization, and of giving them a good example of divinely universal love, unselfishness and spiritual greatness. That is why there are some countries today where despotism and tyranny are dominant while others are ruled with love and wisdom. This will gradually disappear and humanity will know the great initiates and their secret sciences only through historical records, tradition and legend. However, even in the darkest period of human development, by virtue of the laws of heredity, there will be the possibility that a son of God may be born in a human body in order to show humanity the way out of darkness and misery. Father, I ask, is our country the country of the sons of God? No, my child. The continent which once was the home of the sons of God has been completely destroyed. Gradually there were fewer and fewer descendants of the divine race. They left their mortal frames behind them and did not reincarnate themselves. Finally there were only a few left in various parts of the earth to transmit dominion to the human beings who were constantly growing in power. Because of the interbreeding of the two races, however, there arose some individuals with a knowledge of magic acquired from their fathers and the animal-like, physically oriented selfishness of their mothers. These were able to infiltrate into the temple, and by virtue of their spiritual powers, they received initiation. However, they degraded their knowledge to black magic and made selfish use of their own powers and the natural forces they controlled with the instruments and equipment of the temple. The sons of God who were then still living in this part of the earth saw what was coming. They knew that these powers mercilessly destroy anyone who uses them wrongly, that is, with satanic selfishness instead of with divine unselfishness. They knew the black magicians were headed straight for perdition and their blind avarice would cause general destruction. So the last sons of God built huge ships, closed on all sides and even insulated against the forces which penetrate and dissolve matter. Then they secretly took aboard a few of their instruments, their families and their domestic animals, and closing all openings, they sailed away from the part of the earth that was to be destroyed. Some sailed north, some east, some south, while some, sailing westward, arrived here where we are now. The black magicians soon lost control over their instruments. It should have been their task to conduct the highest cosmic divine forces into these instruments and store them there, because the only source of this power on earth is the human being himself. But the more selfish these people became, the more a change took place in the current with which they charged these instruments for later use. One day, when the sons of God in their insulated ships had already sailed away to a sufficient distance, the tragedy occurred. One of the black magicians unintentionally conducted into his own body a force which dissolves matter, that is, changes it into another form of energy. When this process has once been set in motion, the matter which has been transformed into energy goes on, acting as a destructive force, until it has dematerialized everything. In this way the whole continent was destroyed. Finally the new forces thus created slowed down and eventually halted the process of disintegration. The entire dematerialized continent was transformed into energy of radiation, at first rising up to the upper reaches of the Earth's atmosphere, then returning transformed into the primordial form of all matter. After further transformation processes, the whole gigantic mass fell to earth again in what appeared to be an unending downpour of water, mud and sand. The waters of the oceans rolled over the gigantic cleavage in the body of the earth. The land masses of the other hemisphere, split asunder by the cataclysmic shake-up, moved farther and farther apart in order to restore equilibrium throughout the earth, until they finally occupied their present positions. Part of the destroyed continent now lies in our country as a mighty desert of sand, and there is a danger that winds may carry abroad these mountains of sand and cover up fertile, inhabited areas. The sons of God in their ships had special instruments and equipment to stabilize their vessels and keep them horizontal at all times. Thus they survived the catastrophes and finally landed. In every part of the earth where they set foot they began a new civilization. With their knowledge, wisdom and love they won the hearts of the natives. They became rulers. They were worshipped, revered as gods or demigods. Their first acts were to construct suitable buildings for their secret instruments in order to insulate them completely from the world outside and provide adequate protection against the powerful, penetrating energy stored up in their instruments. These buildings, which we call pyramids, can now be seen in all the various parts of the earth where the sons of God fled with the instruments they salvaged. Profoundly impressed, I listened to the story of these tremendous events. It cleared up many things I had not understood before, but not everything. How did the sons of God bring these mighty blocks of stone and set them in place, one upon the other? I asked. Do you remember, my child, the Pharaoh replied, that I told you the sons of God did not need to work with physical force because they cause the forces of nature to work for them? We still possess some of these instruments with which we can control the gravitational force of the earth at will, neutralizing it or amplifying it, depending on the result we wish to achieve. In this way we can make an object weightless or, inversely, even heavier than it normally is. When a huge block of stone has been made weightless in this way, even a child could push it about with its little finger or raise it to any desired height. Ships were piled high with these gigantic blocks of stone without being overloaded, because the blocks had been subjected in advance to the proper form of radiation and so made weightless. All the gigantic edifices, here and in other parts of the world, which human power would never have been able to build were erected by the sons of God in this way. Wherever the sons of God disembarked from their ships, they created a high civilization. wherever they are still ruling. They are leading the people in unselfish love and making a sacrifice for their benefit. The sacrifice of remaining here on earth for a time in order to teach them and propagate spiritual powers.